So you can tell by the introduction music, which right now is mostly placeholder music, that this is not an episode of Ask an Atheist, but it is put together by a lot of the same people that do Ask an Atheist. And this is the first episode of something we're calling Professional Refutationalist Quarterly. And with me here is Becky. How are you?
I'm okay, Sam. How are you?
Doing pretty good. It's a different kind of show. And the idea of it goes back to 2012 when we were doing the winter poll, polling our listeners, seeing what was interesting to people and what wasn't. And there were two things that people wanted to see more of. One of them was more science.
We've done pretty well on that. We had a great episode on GMOs and the controversy behind those.
And we've done a lot of science stuff. The other side of it is debate. So thus we have Professional Refutationalist Quarterly.
So Sam, I mean, Professional Refutationalist Quarterly, what does one do in order to merit the title of professional?
Well, I don't get paid for it, maybe. I mean, that's usually what defines professional and not professional. And in that case, I am not yet a professional refutationalist. But
so tongue-in-cheek in this sense, then.
It's a little tongue-in-cheek. Professional refutationalist is how I described a lot of the podcasts that I listened to about the atheism movement back in the day, back around 2006, when I was doing a lot of podcasting listening and then started thinking about getting into it myself. Well, I wanted the show that I was working on and the show that eventually became Ask an Atheist with, you know, Mike and Casey and other people. I didn't just want it to be a group of professional refutationalists hearing religious arguments and constantly striking them down. That's not hard, and that would make for a very short TV show. We wanted something that looks a lot like what Ask an Atheist is.
Okay, so you're kind of going back a little bit to those roots, but not completely, just making it a very short TV show or very short radio show.
Yeah, and I think there is merit in debate. It's not that I'm against debate. I have a shelf full of high school debate trophies. You know, it's not what I wanted Ask an Atheist to be. I wanted it to be about the community.
So do you see refutation as limited to debate, or do you think that refuting religious claims can occur with dialogue as well?
That's really what I'm going for. I don't know that I'm necessarily going to be the guy debating, but there will definitely be debate going on. I don't have any intentions of being an impartial moderator in these episodes. My opinions are going to be known, but there are some things that I want to talk about. In fact, some things that aren't even particularly religious. Like, I would actually like to do an episode of PRQ about veganism or vegetarianism. Well, more veganism, because it has a stronger moral stance, and actually hash out the morality of veganism or the scientific efficacy of vegan diets, and just actually have that conversation on the show in a way that we really couldn't do in Ask an Atheist, which is why PRQ isn't a radio show. It's a podcast, which means we can take the time we need to make our points or to really sink our teeth into something.
So Ask an Atheist has relied a lot on some listener feedback. Do you see listener feedback playing as significant a role in PRQ as it does?
I should hope. Yeah, it's going to be a separate feed, but it's going to be hosted on the Ask an Atheist website. And the way we're going to probably tie them together is we're going to run commercials for PRQ on the show. So I expect to get a lot of feedback. And just like Ask an Atheist, I want to work with that feedback. So I don't want to make it just us talking to you. It's a show about debate and dialogue. And I want it debate and dialogue between people on the show and people listening to the show.
So Ask an Atheist focused a lot on giving voice to the non-religious, because we observed that religious people really have scads of media outlets and networks and pulpits.
Right, and that's honestly another reason why I don't really want to make PRQ a radio show, is if they want to... PRQ is going to have a lot of people, like today's episode, you're going to be witness to. You know, Ray Comfort is going to witness to you. He's going to tell you his story. He's going to tell you why you should believe in God. That's something that we've really tried to shy away from with Ask an Atheist, is, you know, he's got... Boy, did we see how much media access he has when we went down there. You know, in order to actually have these conversations with people, we need to give them time to say those things so that we can effectively discuss them.
So you don't really feel too badly about giving religious folks or giving apologists to other claims or assertions an audience of some sort, as long as you air a lot of different sort of discussions surrounding those claims or assertions?
You can't deny claims that you don't listen to, is what it comes down to. So I fully intend on having some of these things in PRQ fully discussed, fully brought forth, and all of that. And we will do our best, especially in the case of religious claims, to say why they're wrong. And the thing is, it's not... I'm expecting, you know, I'm not expecting to come out of this suddenly a religious believer, of course, because honestly, I haven't heard a new religious argument in quite some time. But I'm honestly going to give him a fair shake. That's important to me, is, and that's something I feel I can do, is if somebody gives me a really novel concept, I promise that I will really think about it and sort of, you know, sit down in it and get comfortable and see how I feel about it before I just go, hey, that's kind of silly.
Well, I know that it was a very interesting experience going to Living Waters Ministry. You and I talking with Ray Comfort.
The thing about Ray Comfort is this interview we got purely accidentally, which is part of the reason why it was recorded in our field recorder and not on our portable studio.
It was very unexpected and kind of offhand saying, oh yeah, that would be kind of fun to meet Ray Comfort.
Yeah, it was our second tour, or it was our second show of the tour. We were in Orange, California, and we were doing the show, and just as an aside, during the show, somebody said, well, if you want to talk to Ray Comfort, we can introduce you because he lives around here. And I'm like, yeah, I'd love to meet Ray Comfort. I didn't think anything would come of it because I hear, you know, you hear stuff like that a lot. And when you're only in town for a couple minutes, it's hard to get that stuff together.
So meanwhile, 11 a.m., we get a text message, okay. Right?
It was basically Ray Comfort would like the pleasure of your company at 2 p.m. And so we had 3 hours to figure out what we were going to say to Ray Comfort when we met him.
Yes, we did. And I can tell you, I wasn't sure what I would say. And then I can also tell you that the tour of his facility was like stepping into another world.
Yeah, it was, Wheel of Fortune, when somebody would win a round of Wheel of Fortune and then they would have the camera panning over all this expensive stuff and the contestant say would like, yes, I'd like 4 of those gold encrusted pianos and maybe, yeah, that diamond flamingo you've got there. Yeah, I'll take one. That's what it was like for me. It was everything that I would have wanted in a media production facility they had because, well, my budget is what I can get out of a streamathon and their budget is something like $3.6 million.
Yeah, I think that we'd have to do significant different streamathons in order to swing that.
Yeah, maybe convert.
I don't see that happening anytime soon.
I don't either.
Despite spending all that time that Friday afternoon with Mr. Comfort, he did not end up having 2 believers made.
I had 3 hours. I wasn't ready to debate him. And honestly, the debating Ray Comfort thing has been done by some really good folks. I mean, specifically the ACA guys. What I wanted to do was try and talk to the man behind the propaganda. I wanted to see what Ray Comfort was like as a human being.
There's a lot of propaganda there that goes into that human being.
Well, yeah. And so that's what it comes down to. And so I'm not, here it is. Here is our, I'll just give you the interview and you can tell me what you think is behind the Living Waters Ministries propaganda that is Ray Comfort.
I am sitting at this Living Waters Ministries, correct?
Mm-hmm.
With Ray Comfort. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks. You've been told about our show. My show's called Ask an Atheist. But the interesting thing is, this show would not exist if you hadn't done the Does God Exist talk on Nightline in 2007. But strangely enough, it wasn't, I had just decided that it was time for me to be a little bit more public about my atheism. Richard Dawkins was on in response to CNN having the panel discussion about atheists being the most hated minority, and then there were no atheists on the panel. And then a few weeks later, there was that talk, and I was actually surprised how we looked. How the Rational Response Squad looked, and it was actually that made me decide that maybe I should be a little bit more public, because that's not how I want to be portrayed in the media.
So you're saying I was the initial cause?
You were the first cause.
So you believe in the first cause? Yeah, that was a little nightmare for me. The atheists didn't want to fly, so I said okay. The guy that did Brian.
Brian.
He didn't like to fly. He's scared of flying. So I said, okay, we'll do it in New York. He says, I don't want more than 100 people on there because he's afraid of getting shot.
Really?
And yeah. So I had to say, okay, this is restricted. And I said, what am I going to do? I can't open it to all our people because it'll flood this place. There'll be over 1,000 people there and they'll freak out. So I just said to the Baptist guy, I didn't even know him, the guy that owned the church, could you get, 50 of your people together? And I think Brian brought 50 atheists. Well, the 50 people that we had on our side probably didn't know who Kirk was. They were just kind of elderly people, and the atheists were very... And so when there was applause from the atheists, it was like roaring, and our side was kind of pathetic because it didn't have many supporters in it then. It was, it really felt lopsided, but it was a great opportunity, and I was thrilled for it.
One of the things I've noticed is you sort of act as a foil or maybe I might even go so far as to say occasional troll to the atheism community.
Could you define troll for me? Everyone keeps calling, and I don't really. This troll is a guy that sits under a bridge.
Well, that's where it comes from. But yeah. I think, and I'm someone who can have a respect for that because, well, it's like comedy. But what trolling is on the internet is basically picking fights and it just basically drawing people out into acting in a specific way that you know they're going to act. It's going to make them look bad. It's basically just showing people things that they might not have noticed about themselves that they may not necessarily like. To me, that's sort of what the heart of trolling is. It's kind of like stand-up comedy where you say something about society that a lot of people know, but they don't talk about.
Right.
You know, and I think that's kind of what that's sort of the nice trolling. There's a bad trolling, which is just bullying and all that stuff. And I don't really think that's what you're doing. So I'm not accusing you of that.
I kick the hornet's nest, if that's another way. If that's trolling, I deliberately do that. I do it when I'm open air preaching because I've learned if you're passive and sweet and nice, no one will listen to you.
Right.
So when you speak, you've got to be on the edge. And if you want someone to heckle you from the crowd, you've got to say, come on, step up. What's wrong with you? Get on that box.
Mm-hmm.
If you're nice and polite, everyone will just leave.
Yeah.
And they've got a right to. And so you've got to speak on the edge. And I kind of do that on my Facebook page a little bit, just say something provocative and it brings people out. And so you get a healthy discussion. And I love that.
Now, there's probably lots of religious believers and religious people that don't believe as you do. But it seems that you specifically target atheists. Would you say that that's accurate, or would you say that you're there to sort of target and speak to any kind of religious believer or atheist?
Yeah, I speak to anyone, but atheists target me. I've got a Facebook page where I've banned 2,600 atheists for bad language, and they just keep coming back. I started the Facebook page to encourage Christians, and then all the atheists came, and I love it, and I love meeting atheists. I love going to meals with atheists, and I've got a lot of atheist friends, and so I don't look on atheists as enemies at all.
Basically, the atheist following that you have, and I know you call your website Atheist Central occasionally,
No, that's gone.
Oh, that's gone?
It got boring for me about 4 years ago,
okay.
So I just dropped it, so now it's just my Facebook page. But the Facebook page was started without atheists, and they all came.
Yeah, I don't think that's... I think there's something to what you said about it.
You did ask a question. I didn't really answer it. Shall I give
it
a go
for it, absolutely.
When I was in New Zealand, New Zealand's down under by Australia, I did open air speaking every day for about 12 years in a place called Speaker's Corner. And I used to do the banana thing regularly, and then I put a little track together, a little booklet, like one of the chick tracks, but a little thicker, called The Atheist Test, and it sold over 1 million little booklets. And so I've been doing that silly banana thing for 30 years before it became whatever you call it, infamous, if you call it that.
An internet meme, maybe?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's just crazy. And that is probably attributed to why so many atheists kind of hang around the banana thing. And I was a guest speaker at American Atheists in 2001 at their platform, speaker at their convention. So that may have happened. And then I've got books out. You can lead an atheist to evidence, but you can't make him think. God doesn't believe in atheists. And that may have attributed to the fact that it's not a following of atheists, but atheists hang around.
It seems to be, but I mean, when you write books like You Can Lead an Atheist to Water, but You Can't Make Him
evidence.
Think, and stuff like that, you're addressing the atheist community. Was that an intentional choice, or was it just an opportunity that presented itself that you've capitalized on?
No, it's actually to Christians, because Christians feel intimidated by atheists.
Really?
Of course. The average Christian mom who's going to church with the kids, an atheist comes up to, she wouldn't have a clue what to say to an atheist. You know, and so this ministry exists to equip Christians on how to fight the good fight, just how to share their faith without a feeling of intimidation, because we don't need to feel intimidated.
Is fighting actually necessary?
Yeah, it's like the Salvation Army. If you read Scripture, the Salvation Army are an army, and the Christians, we're soldiers of Christ, and Ephesians 6 speaks of the shield of faith, the sword of the Spirit, and it's and love is our weapon, and kindness, and goodness, and gentleness, all these things are weapons that we use. We're not it's a spiritual warfare, it's not a physical war. I'd shoot someone. Well, if someone's attacking my wife with a knife, I'll shoot them in the foot and work up.
Right.
To protect her, but I wouldn't, I'm not a violent person.
Can I ask about your heritage?
Yes, certainly.
So you're including yourself, presumably, in your speak of Christians and we, and this is our ministry.
Yes.
But your original ethnicity and sort of cultural heritage
from a religious perspective, is not Christian.
No.
And so your mother was originally Jewish?
Full Jew, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so do you then identify as Jewish, sort of ethnically or culturally?
Not really. My mom didn't even know who Moses was.
Okay.
I never went to synagogue until I became a Christian. I was born just after the end of the Second World War, and my mum and dad were afraid of another Holocaust, so I think they put Methodist on my birth certificate or something like that. And so I was brought up without any Christian or religious instruction whatsoever.
So within the Jewish community, religion is passed on through matrilineal descent, and so there are a great many Jews that would consider you to be Jewish purely because your mother was,
yes,
was Jewish.
Yes, absolutely.
And how do you sort of respond to that?
I think it's nice. It got me into the synagogue in New York before I was kicked out about an hour later when they found out I was a Christian.
Right. Oh, I have always had a question about your printing of The Origin of Species.
Yes.
It always kind of wondered me about this, because in the original printing, I know you've since corrected it, but in the original printing, you left out some chapters, including the one on the fossil record.
Things that the fossil record doesn't explain.
And it seems like something that would have shored up your argument. I've always wondered why that wasn't included. Was it just...
Totally my mistake, because it was getting so thick, it was costing too much to print. So
okay.
I says, okay, we just have to drop four chapters from somewhere, take that one out. I'd read it was so boring, I thought it wouldn't make any difference whatsoever. And so it was a cost-effective thing. And then it wasn't a deliberate leaving out of important chapters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the point wasn't Origin of Species. The point was I wanted to make a point with the...
I sort of wondered if you were making the connection between atheists and the Origin of Species and Christians and the Bible, in that you modified the Origin of the Species just to see if people would get outraged.
Not at all.
Okay.
I just knew that people would take a free Origin of Species and they'd put up with my forward because of a free book. And they did. We gave out, I think, 200,000 in a day. And Richard Dawkins wasn't very happy about it. He told people to rip out that the foreword.
Did he not?
Yeah. He's online telling students in Canada to rip it out. My thought is, if I'm an idiot like he says I am, leave it in and let them read what an idiot I'm at.
I tend to be along that lines as well. I mean, I'm an educator, and so I say if something has been written, then it's worthy of close analysis and criticism, whether it's a piece of text or a commentary, or I don't leave the Bible out of that. I don't leave any religious scriptures out of that field of text. That's to be great. Analyzed.
Yeah.
And with us is Kent from the Orange, California show. We actually recorded that last night. So,
well, it should be analyzed unabridged. I mean, the reason that we like Uncle Tom's Cabin, books like that, or a lot of Mark Twain's writing, certainly some of the language in there is quite offensive to our modern sensibilities, but the reason that we want to read it unabridged is because it informs us as to what the time was like, what the people were like, how society was functioning at that time.
Did you know Twain wasn't an atheist?
Now, what is your evidence for that?
I just wrote a book on it.
Really?
Yes.
Have you read Letters from the Earth?
Yes. It's fantastic.
You don't find that to be a defense of his own atheism?
No, he was angry at religion. Just mad. And I am too. The hypocrisy. That's what his offense was. And he hated the God of the Bible. But he had his own concept of God. If you look at his writings, he believed God was standoffish.
So a deist.
Yeah, and far more majestic than the God of the tyrant that's painted in the Bible quotes. That's where Richard Dawkins, I think, got a lot of his, you know, he's got his big spiel about the God of the Bible being a tyrant, etc. Well, you can find that in the writings of Mark Twain. And so, yeah, he believed in God's existence. He just didn't like the God of the Bible, probably because of his moral accountability. He was a very promiscuous gentleman.
So you find the God as it's portrayed in the Bible as, you said the God that Twain believed in is far more majestic than the one portrayed in the Bible.
Yes.
Is that the kind of God that you believe in, or do you actually believe in the God of the
God
Bible?
God of the Bible, because I find the God that Mark Twain believed in is an absolute tyrant. Even though he says he's majestic and paints him as magnificent, he stands off and lets people die of cancer, kids die of cancer, and he leaves humanity without hope in this dilemma called death. At least the God that I believe in, the God of the Bible, invaded this earth, gives us a reason as to why we've got suffering and death and all these things, because we live in a fallen creation. He provides a savior. Twain's doesn't. He just stands aloof and couldn't care less after he made the earth.
So what's your reason for believing that a child would die of cancer?
That we live in a fallen creation, that every 24 hours, 40,000 children die of starvation. We've got disease. So when I was a kid, I opened a medical book and I was horrified. There wasn't 100 diseases. There were thousands.
Well, and there are many religious people and atheists alike that think that is tyrannical.
That's sort of the dichotomy here that I'm having trouble with, is you think Twain's God is a tyrant, if Mark Twain believed in a God, and Twain thought your God was a tyrant, and a lot of us in the atheist community feel that God, as portrayed in the Bible, is a tyrant.
I can understand that.
For a lot of the same reasons, the theodicy problem, if that's how it's pronounced anyway. Mm-hmm. I find this really kind of shocking that you would sort of flip the script like that.
Well, there's a reason for it, and I can give you an analogy if I may. Let me tell you about my dad. My dad used to beat me up when I was a kid. I saw him kill an animal with his bare hand, and he'd leave my mom to raise the kids while he was off other place. So your image of my father is a tyrant, a horrible, horrible father. But the reason he beat me is if I told a lie or stole something, there was a little strap in the middle drawer, and we got it. He cared enough to tell me right from wrong. The animal he killed was a bird that had been hit, was on the side of the road, was dying, and it horrified him to do it, but he got out and he killed that bird because it was in suffering. And the reason he left my mom to raise the kids is because he is a carpenter and he is out working to give us food for the table. So I've given you extra information that showed that the portrayal that I gave you of my father was wrong. I gave you more information. Richard Dawkins is an idolater. An idolater usually goes through the Bible and picks the nice things about God. God is merciful, kind, loving. He's not a God of wrath or judgment. And the main God they can cuddle up to. That's called idolatry. Richard Dawkins does the opposite. He goes through the Old Testament and takes all the judgments of God and he creates a monster. And he says, if that's your God, get rid. I don't want anything to do with him. And so he should, because that God doesn't exist. He's a figment of Dawkins' imagination.
But Fair enough.
So the God that Richard Dawkins doesn't believe in doesn't exist. It's idolatry. Now, the reason I can look at Old Testament things, that judgments of God that are horrific, is because I've got more information in the New Testament. The God I believe in came to this earth as Jesus of Nazareth and gave his life on a cross and took the punishment for my sins and showed God's love for me in that. And he defeated death and he revealed himself to me on the 25th of April, 1972, 1:30 in the morning. Not through visions, not through things, but it just transformed me in an instant, so everything looked different. So I've got extra knowledge that you guys haven't, so this tyrant is not a tyrant. He's a merciful, loving, kind God that gave us all these things that we so enjoy.
Are you suggesting a source other than the Bible for information, or is it in the Bible?
New Testament.
Yeah.
The Old Testament paints God as more harsh, but in the Old Testament, God tells you to love your neighbor as yourself, and there's absolute kindness and mercy.
Well, presumably, we're all literate in English language, and we have access to the New Testament as well, but you just said that you have knowledge that we don't.
Experiential knowledge. It's like you don't know my wife, but I do. I experience her.
How do you validate your experience of a being that overwhelmed you with his presence and saved you? How do you know that wasn't just created by your own mind?
That is a good point. What happened is the Bible didn't convert me. The Bible was an instruction book that told me what I'd experienced. Because when I became a Christian, everything looked different. The sky looked different. The trees raised their arms to God. The flowers blossomed to his glory. Birds sung his praises. I thought, what is happening? Everything is just, my eyes are just different. And I thought, what's happened? Open up the scriptures and it says the eyes of your understanding have been enlightened. You are alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in you, because of the blindness of your heart. I thought, why have I got this peace that I can't understand? Scripture says you've got a peace that passes all understanding. Why do I feel like I'm bubbly on the inside? It speaks of joy unspeakable. So if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. All things are passed away. So I realized
you have to acknowledge that none of that is empirical. There's no way we can test that or validate that.
And if the Bible is written by human beings, human beings experience emotions. When they become part of a community, they feel better. And
absolutely.
If they're just writing their observations, I mean, it's not just the Bible that says stuff like that. The Torah has bits like that.
Every major
religion talks about, and we are social creatures. We evolved in sort of tribal units. Well, I think, you know, we could have that debate, but we seek we've always sought meaning through each other. We exist as a community.
Everything's subjective though. You're going by emotion and your own subjective experiences right at this moment. But the Bible validated my experience. But yeah, you're right. But the first time I was born, it was radical. I didn't exist. And then I did, like 9 months, and then I did. And here I am. The second time I was born again was just as radical. Absolutely radical. New heart, new desires.
I see what you did there.
What?
9 months, then I was born.
Yes.
I was born, then 9 months, then I was born. I see what you did there.
But some people can read things in other books in religious tradition, in the traditions of other religious communities, or in a cognitive psychology textbook, and be equally validated in their experience. Their experience of seeing something while they're on psychedelic drugs will be explained and validated through other kinds of writings.
Yeah.
And so what is the difference between your writing that validated your experience and the other writing?
Well, let me just say, if I didn't believe in electricity, raw electricity, and you said I can't can't show it to you. These are just manifestations, but I can show you it does exist. Here's a fork to get up that light socket. You'd believe the moment you experience the power. And that's what eternal salvation is when you become a Christian. And I don't mean religious. There's a lot of hypocrisy out there. When you come to know God, it is experiential. You cannot describe it. I interviewed a young lady at a university recently. She came up to me with a white cane. And I thought, being perceptive, she's blind. So I said, can I interview you? And she said, yeah. And she sat down. I got her mother's permission. She was 23. First question was, tell me about blue. What is blue like? And she said an amazing thing. She said, blue is a very sad color. And I said, why do you say that? She said, because people get the blues. And in her world, in her dark world, she had no concept of the magnificence of a blue sky. And before I was a Christian, I was alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that's in me because of the blindness of my heart. Like amazing grace, I once was blind, but now I see. When I became a Christian, when I got that light, suddenly everything was different. And you cannot explain it, but you couldn't explain blue to a blind man.
So I appreciate earlier you were very keen on answering Sam's question that you were sort of working around, and I don't feel like your response answered my question of you found validation of your experience in Christian scriptures and other people find validation of their experiences and explanations through other texts. And so what would make one piece of text more valid?
I can't think of anything that you're giving me that compares to what I experienced. I can't think of anything that validates what you've said. Can you be more specific? Is there some book out there that tells you if you do this, God will reveal himself to you and give you everlasting life and seal you with the Holy Spirit and make you a new person on the inside and open the eyes of your understanding? I can't think of any religion or book that does that. Just people.
I must disagree. There are tons of books out there that say this is how you can know God. There's the entire Gnostic movement. There's the Quran. This is Allah revealing himself through. There are thousands of books that try to tell you how to reach various concepts behind the idea of God.
Or even in a non-religious context, that's something that validates someone else saying, yeah, this is how you self-actualize. You go into Barnes & Noble and the self-help section is huge, compared to, I mean, it's larger than cooking, it's larger than architecture.
This is the reason why Deepak Chopra drives a nice car.
Yeah.
This is what I'm getting to is when we talk about emotions, we talk about feelings, feelings are very individualized. We all find meaning from different things. But then you're finding this deep emotional meaning from the Bible. And then you're saying that your deep emotional connection to this book means that reality was put together a certain way. That's the link I have trouble with. I don't see that. I can understand getting meaning through a story. There's meaning I get through certain stories that I know aren't true. But that's the thing is it's beyond you saying that I got personal meaning out of this book. And it's another thing entirely to say that this book defines and encompasses reality, the universe that we exist in.
Mm.
And that's a confusion I have there. That's a link that I don't see.
You know, the thing that convinced me that Christianity was real was one Bible verse. Do you want to hear what it is?
Sure.
You sure?
Please tell me it's John 3:16.
No, it's not. That is so overused. It was Matthew 5, 20, 20, I think, 21, 22, where Jesus said, if you look at a woman and lust for her, you commit adultery with her in your heart. When I saw that, my heart sank. Not that I'd done something wrong, but I was horrified that God was saying it was wrong. And this is why I was horrified and almost annoyed, is that as a surfer, if I wanted to enjoy myself, I had to go and dangle my legs as shark bait in cold water. It took an effort to enjoy myself. To enjoy myself on the weekends, we'd have to get drunk and go to a party and look for fun and all the stuff that comes with it. It took effort to enjoy yourself. But with lust, instantaneous and unending. Was just made boring life worth living for a red-blooded male, teenage male. So when God was saying it was wrong, that really bugged me. But then I understood that God said it was wrong and he had provided a savior so my transgression should be forgiven. And when I asked God to forgive me, he gave me a new heart with new desires, so I wanted to do that which is right rather than that which is wrong. That's the miracle in conversion. You say, how can you know? Man, I didn't care about righteousness before I was a Christian. I drank iniquity like water, like the Bible says. When I became a Christian, suddenly, above all things, I wanted to please God. And I know there's all different religions. You talk about Islam and Hinduism, but there's a huge difference between biblical Christianity and all those religions. Those religions are what what's called works righteousness religions. They say you have to do something to merit eternal life. You have to lie in beds and nails, you have to face meek, you have to pray, you have to fast, etc. Christianity says, no, no, there's a different equation. We're criminals, and anything you offer God, because God's a judge, is an attempt to bribe him. The only thing that can save you is not your works. That won't get you to heaven. It's a free gift from God. It comes by the judge's mercy. That's the huge difference. God provided everlasting life as a gift. All those religions say you have to try and earn it by doing things.
But this is where I think the tyranny of your God concept sort of shows itself. You are already a criminal. You start out a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Original sin. And if I wanted to control a population, if I wanted to keep people in line, that is by its very nature Orwellian. Mm-hmm. You have already broken the law in your mind or in your heart. And in order to become a good member of society or a good Christian or get your Eagle Scout badge, you have to follow these specific rules. And to me, you think of it as religion, you think of it as a creator of the universe. To me, it's always looked like just methods of social control.
Right, and you're right. Religion is the opiate of the masses. Absolutely, and there's control in religion all over the place. I hate that, from cults to the great big religions that have a head that tells you what's right and what's wrong. I hate all that stuff. When I became a Christian, there was no rules I had to follow. Eternal life is a free gift of God. And the reason I follow rules is because I want to. I don't commit adultery because I want to be faithful in my life. I don't lie and steal because it's not right. So all the rules that I follow come from my own heart, my own desires to not some religion telling me what to do and what not to do.
This is where I get a little confused, though. The line that gets thrown at me a lot is, the fool says there is no God and stuff like that.
The fool is in his heart, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they say that I don't want to interface with God because I want to keep living the life I'm living. But you just told me that you're interfacing with God so that you can continue living the life you're living.
No, it's a completely different life. You don't do the things you used to do. You don't sin anymore when you're a Christian.
But you could have, as long as, because it's not about your good works or your good deeds or following rule set.
It's about a decision.
It's just about your...
That would be hypocrisy, and that would be offensive to me. I couldn't live as a hypocrite. You can call me everything you want. Call me a hypocrite, and I just die inside.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you disagree with me, I'd like you to think, well, at least I believe what I believe, and I live what I believe.
Yeah, well, I'm actually, honestly, this is something I don't get. And there's actually a similarity between us. Mm-hmm. I was not raised religious either.
Mm-hmm.
I was, my father was agnostic. My mother was Lutheran. There was a sort of an understanding between them that religion would be something that I would seek myself, rather than something that was
right.
impressed upon me. So when I was in my teenage years, did the grand tour of religions. I tried some of the Eastern religions. There was the New Age movement. I did my share of Christian churches, the Baptist churches. I went to the Lutheran church. I went to a Catholic mass. And it was people telling me I had the God-shaped hole in my heart. And I needed to go fill it. And so
I just stop there and just mention something? I've
sure.
written a book talking about the fallacy of that whole God-shaped
pattern. Okay.
And it's totally unbiblical, totally wrong. It's caused devastation and ended up with a lot of atheists having your experience. The book is called God is a Wonderful Plan for Your Life, The Myth of the Modern Message. Totally unbiblical.
That's sort of a side point here. My main point is I didn't feel it that way. And none of this stuff really made sense to me. So when I ask you about, why am I a fool for living the way I'm living, even though I'm living exactly like you, just without the God thing? I'm honestly confused about this. What is the difference between us? Why do you think you managed to get this religion and it just sort of fell off me like I'm coated in Teflon?
Probably you came under the sound of the modern gospel, something that is totally unbiblical and has devastated the Church of America. Totally wrong to tell people they've got a God-shaped vacuum in their heart and that God has a wonderful plan.
Let me clarify that. There was friends of mine who told me that there was one church that talked like that. Most of the Christian churches I went to weren't talking like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were really honestly just doing the hard sell and just trying to get me to be a member of it, specifically the Southern Baptist Church I went to.
Mm.
It, from my perspective, it just, the argument never made sense to me. It never spoke to me emotionally. And I really gave it a shot. I know a lot of, when I tell this story, a lot of Christians think, well, I was holding back.
Mm-hmm.
I really
didn't give yourself all the way.
I didn't really want to because atheism to me back then was a scary concept. I didn't want to be the odd man out.
Mm. Maybe you never heard the biblical gospel.
Well, I read the Bible.
Yeah, you can miss it.
Possibly.
You know? Do you want me to give you a synopsis, 40 seconds?
40 seconds?
See if I can do it?
Get to 35, we'll listen.
Okay, 35. God's holy, perfect, righteous. You've got an intuitive knowledge of God within you. God's given light to every man. Every time we sin, we know we do wrong because we've got a conscience. When we lust, we know it's wrong. When we commit adultery, lie, steal, murder, even hate, we have a knowledge that it's wrong. That leaves us morally accountable. We have to face God on judgment day because he's good, he's just and holy. He's going to make sure Hitler's punished, rapists are punished, but he's so good he's going to make sure thieves, liars, fornicators, blasphemers are punished. He doesn't want us to end up in hell and come under his justice. He provided a savior so we could have mercy. Someone who would pay our fine on our behalf, take our punishment so that God could legally dismiss our case. If someone pays your fine, you can walk out of the courtroom. God can let you walk out of the courtroom because of the suffering, death, and the resurrection of Christ. But what you've got to do is not ask Jesus into your heart. You've got to repent of your sins and trust alone in him. When you do that, you'll come to know God.
I've heard that, but then there's the other stuff in the Bible, the sort of the methods that your God uses to bring those things about, and they seem horrible.
Can you give me one?
Well, most of the Old Testament yes. stuff, and actually some of the New Testament stuff too. Why do that to Judas? Why?
Hang on, he didn't do anything to Judas. Judas by his own free will, and Jesus said, why has Satan filled your heart? That's what happened. That Judas deliberately was a thief. He was stealing from the bag. If you read John chapter 12, he was the treasurer, and he was stealing from the collection bag. I mean, how hypocritical is that? He was a false convert.
What about what God did to Pharaoh? So it says God hardened Pharaoh.
That was where I was going to go.
Yeah. He was bringing plagues against Egypt.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like God took away Pharaoh's free will to do anything to save his own people.
Well, if you put butter in sunlight or cheese in sunlight, sunlight can harden it or it can soften it. It just depends which way you look at it. And God's judgments and God's words hardened Pharaoh's heart. You know, so... my consolation is that I believe with all my heart that all of God's judgments are righteous and true altogether. God is not evil, and as atheists, you can't even define evil. You can't make
That's
a moral judgment.
True.
Well, tell me, what is evil?
We can recognize that there are some behaviors that we have developed that are socially adaptive and some that are antisocial.
Such as?
Well, things that harm other people, certainly.
Is pedophilia evil?
Absolutely.
Okay, now what say I can give you a synopsis of a scenario of pedophilia that doesn't harm anyone and actually benefits them? Then is that okay?
I would disagree with that because the context is the differential of power between an older person and a younger person.
Well, let me give you a scenario where pedophilia is okay. Your kid's behind a mirror. They can't see you. They're naked. You film them. You sell the film to perverts. They get paid a lot of money. Parents paid a lot of money. That pays for the kid's education. No harm is done. The kid doesn't know. Therefore, pedophilia in that context must be okay. Because you've got no rock.
No, sorry. Can't go
I'm,
with that.
I'm very
I'm,
concerned
I'm
with this line.
I'm seeing loads of harm in that story.
Okay, well,
yes.
Tell me. Yeah. Why is it wrong?
Why is it wrong?
Yes, what is
because
wrong?
Because there's effective harm. And I'll be honest with you that I have no problem with good and evil because I don't think evil exists as a supernatural concept. There is no evil.
There's
a lot of bad things out there.
Yeah, so you can't
there's
say
bad,
evil.
There's moral, there's amoral. Oh, yeah, I don't use the word evil.
Yeah.
I will say amoral, I will say tragic, I will say terrible, I will say hurtful, I will say horrible, but not evil. Because evil implies some sort of supernatural, like some evil specter, supernatural force
so
that's invading
you
people.
You cannot define there's such a thing as evil.
It's not about not being able
but we can
to define it.
But evil does not equal harm. We can still talk about harm. Harm is real, harm exists, we can
it's
track
measured.
Harm, there's evidence of harm. We can measure it.
We can measure
the effect that seeing those pictures will have on the children, those pictures, the subject of those pictures, as they become older.
They don't even know
there
about
is potential. What if they stumble upon them?
They might say, I'm an adult.
In the age of the internet,
I'm
entirely possible.
They might say, I'm an adult.
But what
I'm
if they
rich
don't?
Because of them.
But what if they don't?
What's that?
What if they don't? More likely, psychologically, people will be deeply affected
they
by that.
They probably won't even recognize it's them years later.
I'm very alarmed at your line of reasoning here, honestly, as someone who you know, cares deeply for a healthy society and children to have that kind of thing where someone
I
is taken advantage of in that
if
way.
If there's sort of a subtext here that you're trying to get us to say that we're okay with pedophilia.
No, not at all. I'm trying to say usually when I talk to atheists, I say, what is right and wrong? They say, whatever society deems is right is right. Whatever society deems is wrong. It depends on society. Societal. And I say,
you're
okay.
Talking about relativism.
Have you heard us say that?
I haven't heard you say it. Okay. You guys are different, but most atheists I talk to, that's what they get to say. Okay, when is it right when it's wrong? When society says it's okay, then it's okay. Because they've got no basis. Well, as a Christian, I can say it's wrong to murder, it's wrong to commit adultery, it's wrong to lie, it's wrong to steal, it's wrong to blaspheme. it's wrong to live without God first in your life.
You don't think you would have arrived at those same conclusions without Christianity?
I knew those. That was all written in my heart via my conscience. It was confirmed by Christianity.
You can't accept that your conscience, we evolved conscience, that the human race evolved to having a conscience because it enabled us to survive more easily.
I don't know if it does. My conscience bothered me before I was a Christian. It annoyed me.
So those who believe as you do that don't murder and steal and cheat, who arrive at those without Christianity or without a belief in God, do you find that their convictions are authentic?
Yeah, it depends.
So if I say I don't want to murder, I don't want to cheat, and I don't want to steal, but I don't have the same religious belief as you, are my convictions authentic?
Of course, that by your conscience. But the thing is, what the Bible calls sear our conscience, take the life out of it so that you can lie, commit adultery, you can fornicate, knowing it's wrong, but you still go ahead and do it. And what I'm saying is that conscience is like a smoke detector. If you want to take the batteries out, go ahead, but that smoke detector is for your benefit. Your conscience is God-given. It's shaped by society, but it's God-given. And that's what leaves us without excuse on Judgment Day, and that's why we all need
to
save
it. But then we have mental illness. We have, you know, psychopathy, which we don't have that conscience.
Yeah.
People born with that. And it seems like if we're all given these tools so that we can come to God through our conscience, if you don't have one, then you've been kind of been dealt a short stack even before you were
born. Maybe not. In civil law, we won't prosecute someone who's mentally unstable. And that's right. You know, if someone genuinely, I'm not talking about a lot of court cases, a guy rapes a woman and pretends, whatever.
Granted.
But there are people that haven't got mental capabilities. Well, they're not responsible for their actions often.
Do you think of the phenomenon of conscience that you're describing is unique to human beings only?
Yes, I think some animals know right from wrong. My dog, when it goes somewhere where he shouldn't inside, he will cower in a corner. But my dog doesn't set up court systems like human beings do. If a dog steals my dog's bone, my dog doesn't look for a cheap dog, and they set up a court system and send a dog to the doghouse.
So there's some really interesting studies of social behaviors amongst animals like bonobos that will actually altruistically say, no, I'm going to share my portion with you. And then it's not a formal court system, but you will have someone else within the society, within the bonobo group say, oh, if you're taking more than your share, no, we will punish you either through ostracizing you or through beating you and things like that. It's not a court, but we see that reflected in humans societies as well.
Yes.
I guess to wrap up, there's something that we say a lot on the show, which something we say about religious people a lot, actually. We think that morality does come from society. It comes from the interplay. It comes from the back and forth and the interplay between peoples and, people who don't want to be harmed, people who don't want to be hurt, people who want to be stable in their homes and their property and stuff like that. And what we say is that people are better than their religions. And to do it in sort of a way that you do it, do you keep slaves?
No, I don't. No, why would I keep slaves?
Exactly. Do you...
stone homosexuals.
Pardon?
Do I stone homosexuals?
No, I was going to say, do you beat your wife?
Sometimes... Well, she beats me up most mornings. She gets up about 5:30. I get up about 6.
I think I understand why.
I don't have slaves, and I don't stone homosexuals. Why would I instigate 3,000-year-old Hebrew law in American society? We've got our own laws. If someone, murders someone, they'll put him in the electric chair, or they'll hang him, or shoot him, or put him in jail for the rest of his life. We have our own laws, our own punishment.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And to me, I derive a lot of value of humanity through that, is that the Bible, from my reading of the Bible, says some things that I consider immoral, and that I would consider Christians immoral if they did.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go to the churches, and you see that you meet the Christians and you talk to them, and they've outgrown all of that. That's no longer moral to them either.
Mm-hmm.
People are much better than their religions. People are more moral, they're more respectful, they're nicer than their religions tell them to. And that's where I get a lot of my hope.
Well, being a Christian has got nothing to do with being good. Do you realize that?
That's not the way most people have it, and that's certainly not the way what it says in the Bible.
You mentioned hypocrisy. You said that if someone accepted Christ and devoted their life to him, that they would also, they would do away with their, they would repent of their sin.
Yeah.
That if they were to sin again, it would be hypocrisy.
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with being good. When you become a Christian, God gives you everlasting life as a gift. Instantaneously, like grease lightning, you receive the gift of everlasting life. Then you live a good moral life, not to merit everlasting life. You've already got that. You live a good life out of gratitude to God for his mercy. Like a criminal, the judge says, I feel sorry for you, I'm paying your fine. Because I feel sorry, no other reason. Here, $10,000, you're out of here. Well, that criminal, if he really seen one, the judge has just done for him, will go and live a life that's free of crime. Because he's grateful.
Jean Valjean.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's the difference. I mean, it's like, you ask what the difference between you and I are. or you and me is, whatever the correct term is. I'm from New Zealand, we have different things.
Yeah.
But if we're standing on the edge of a plane 10,000 feet up, I'm wearing a parachute, you're not, okay? I'm not better than you, I'm just better off than you, because we both have to jump. And you and I, the only difference between us is I have a savior, I have a parachute. When I pass through death, I am saved from the moral law, eternal justice, not because I'm good, but because I'm trusting in Christ. And so my heart's desire is that people like you put on Christ. I'm not out to say join a church. There's hypocrisy out there. I'm not saying I don't want your money. I'm saying, please think about your salvation. It's eternal. This is what we're talking about. You don't know when death is going to seize on you.
From my perspective, the parachute's on the other body. This is not a test. We need to help each other. We need to create as much joy as possible. We need to make something meaningful in our lives through the memories of other people. And that would be, if I were to be an evangelist, which I'm really not, that would be the kind of thing that I would say is, this life is important. You shouldn't live your life as this doesn't matter. You shouldn't live your life as this is only a preface to something greater, because there's no evidence for it. Even if that's true, we still need to make this place as good as possible.
You would be a very popular evangelist, and you'd be rich. Because everyone would love you. But when you speak the truth in love, when you tell people the truth, they're going to hate you. They're going to despise you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you for Christ's sake. But that's what an evangelist is called to do. If you read the history of the church, the first 11 apostles were murdered for their faith. And then through the book of Acts, Stephen was stoned. You read the book called Fox's Book of Martyrs, what the Catholic Church did to real genuine believers.
Yeah.
So you'd be a popular evangelist, but...
I don't think so.
It'd be a big...
The thing is, there's hard parts of that. There's uncomfortable truths in everything. You know,
I think you'd be a big get for God, though. I mean, that'd be the headline. I mean,
I would clean up on the church circuit, don't get me wrong, but that's just a little too disingenuous for me. There's uncomfortable truths, stuff that you're fighting against. We are animals. There's not much that separates us from animals.
I have to disagree with that.
I know you disagree with that, but that's the kind of thing. But I'm saying there are things I could say that would make me unpopular, and would be stuff like that.
Well, if you're an evangelist that doesn't go by the Bible, you can make up whatever you want.
Yeah, I go by, but the thing is, I can't make up whatever I want if I want to be honest and true. When I want to be honest and true, I have to look at what the evidence says and what we have learned so far. I have to be objective about it. And maybe I would be a good evangelist for saying, you know, nice hippy-dippy things, but I'm certainly not going to be a good evangelist to say, when you die, nothing. Yeah. People don't like that.
A lot of people would.
Not really. No. That's certainly not been my experience. I mean,
Well, if you say that around Christians, they'll be upset.
I actually think that there's a lot of atheists out there who have trouble with that concept. I mean, nobody wants to think about their own self-annihilation.
Woody Allen's a great example.
He's scared of dying, isn't he?
He's deathly afraid of dying.
Yeah.
I think everybody is.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not. I don't like the thought of dying because there's no nice ways to go, but I know where I'm going when I die. Absolutely, 100%, without a doubt. And that's precious to me. And I can pass it on to my children, my wife, and other people that come to Christ.
So that sounds prideful.
Well, it might sound prideful, but to me, it's just very cool. It's like the man who says, I'm wearing a parachute. You're not. Please put yours on. It sounds prideful. Yeah, but it's a fact. Put it on, you know? So I'm sorry if it sounds prideful, but it's not. It's just said in love.
Fair enough. I'll give you that.
Because I care.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
I have absolutely enjoyed it, and I would have loved to keep going for another couple of hours.
Me too.
It's a really interesting experience for us as well.
You're listening to Professional Refutationalist Quarterly. When we return, we'll get Mike Gitlis's reaction to what we've just listened to.
Secular humanism is a non-theistic view of the universe built on a foundation of reason, science, and democracy. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking, and we hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of free thinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. For information on how you can be a part of the humanist activities in the Puget Sound area, become a member of the Humanists of Washington today. Visit humanistsofwashington.org.
Billy!
Not again!
Billy, I'm a certified ghost expert!
Wow, that's so credible!
Billy, your great-great-grandmother says she loves you, and to give me your lunch money!
Aw, anything for family! Here you go!
Wait, Billy! Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence! Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp!
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I know.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Do you have an idea for a website but don't know how to get started? Are you tired of expensive hosting draining your budget dry? Archway Hosting can help. Archway's fully functional hosting service starts at $20 per year and includes hosting, databases, email, and much more. Have an idea for a website or application and don't know where to begin? Check out Archway. They also do web design and development. To get your online presence off to a great start, check out archwayhosting.com. That's ARCHWAY hosting.com.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
All right, welcome back to Professional Refutationalist Quarterly, an Ask an Atheist joint, I guess. I don't know what you'd call it. And with me now is Mike Gillis. Mike, I really wanted you to be at this debate, at this conversation, so that we could be a little bit more debative. And I was a little concerned that when you listened to what we did record, that you wouldn't be too pleased with it.
Well, I'm almost never pleased when I'm listening to Ray Comfort. The thing that I've gotten, and maybe just a Pavlovian response at this point, but hearing his voice makes me just want to stab myself in the eye with a fork. I imagine that if there's any sort of conversation with the guy, it's something where he's just repeating a bunch of things like a parrot that he's memorized,
right,
and there's
right.
no real conversation happening. So yeah, the beginning of the conversation is a lot harder for me to listen to than the second half. Because if he's not being challenged, it just becomes incredibly frustrating because all I want to do is yell at him.
Right, right. Well, in my case, it was, you know, I said, I had 3 hours notice, and to be honest with you, I wasn't going into it particularly fresh. But I wanted to see if there was... I wasn't looking for a debate win. I was looking for a genuine moment. I wanted a moment where, you know, Ray would step out from behind Ray and go, you know what, I don't really like being yelled at by atheists all the time. It really gets me down sometimes. Or, this is not how I expected my career to go. Or, I like the debate. Or, you know, I realize that people, you know, consider what I do to be a jerk. And that moment never came.
Yeah. I think if he disliked being yelled at by atheists, he wouldn't try to intentionally provoke it so much.
Right, right.
And to this day, continues to provoke it that much.
Well, that's the thing. If he said, you know what, I like doing this. Like when in the early, I said, people consider you a troll. And he goes, yeah, but it's fun. That would have been the genuine moment for me.
But the two things that make him a target for ridicule, one of them is the fact that he does troll. And that's what a troll is supposed to get, is a response that exists to elicit or provoke usually a negative response out of the person that they're targeting. But the other thing that makes him a target for trollery is the fact that he is really culturally ignorant. I think he exists in his own little bubble.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he didn't know what troll was, even though he exists as much on the internet as he does,
I think that's a line. I like he said, I don't know what a troll is. I didn't buy that for a minute.
Well, I've seen other instances of this. It may be one is the scenario where somebody on one of his Facebook pages referred to him as a bibliophile, and he freaked out and threatened to ban them.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because
he
didn't know what that word means. And this is the thing that, like with that public access station where people are sending in lyrics to, like, TV sitcoms as if they're letters to a Christian public access TV show, there's nothing that makes you a target like cultural blindness.
That's true.
Because it means, hey, look, I can throw this thing at you that everyone recognizes, but it just shows how out of touch you really are. And you don't even have to be an atheist or a non-believer to laugh at this person at that point.
Right.
Like, like if you're sending them the lyrics to the Family Guy theme song. That trick worked on, like, I believe a Nigerian Christian public access show, or sending them your own personal story of how you became a Christian, and it's really just the opening credits of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. These tricks would work on Ray Comfort too, mm-hmm. because he lives in this own little bubble, and he doesn't seem to understand, I think, that if you're going to be effective as a public speaker in any way, rather than just continue to cultivate and recultivate and dry out the crowd of people that you have, because he has a lot more anti-fans, I suspect, than fans.
I would imagine, but then again, I saw his, I saw his studio.
Oh, yeah, the dude makes some money. There's no doubt about that, and that's what's so funny about him throwing that charge at you, that, oh, you'd make a great televangelist, because you're not telling people that anything that they don't want to hear, and if you don't, but me, I'm a poor little public servant that's going out there telling them the awful truth, and look at my $7 million studio.
Yeah.
And the fact that I have the money to be able to go to hundreds of campuses with my people, this many of them, and hand out copies of this edited version of On the Origin of Species.
If there was one moment in the interview that I wish I had done more with, it was that moment, because that was definitely intended as an insult. I didn't take it as an insult because I was considering the messenger in the message, but...
That's the funny thing, the idea that we're somehow giving people what they want to hear, that really, that's the most hypocritical moment of the thing, which is that if we wanted to make money, mm-hmm. we'd be joining the ex-atheist circuit.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a lot more money in saying, look at this horrible things I've done, and just kind of like the satanic panic stuff from the 80s, you can just make garbage up.
Right.
You can just say, look at these horrible things I was forced to do, and make it sound like a scene out of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. It doesn't have to have any relevance or evidence behind it whatsoever, because with Ray, and this is the question, is Ray is undoubtedly a liar.
Yeah.
That's not a charge that I throw around very lightly, because I think there are people who genuinely believe what they say and really are just wrong, that they're just mistaken. And the things that they come out of their mouths are things that they sincerely think are true. But I think with Ray, he says and does things which are intentionally dishonest. One of them is the way that he edits people. And this is what I found so funny about the interview, where he gets so touchy, not through anything you said. He volunteers this. He injects this into the conversation, where he's saying he does not want to be called a hypocrite.
Yeah.
And I suspect it's because it hits close to home.
I think so, too. And that was really what I was working towards with you, is, and in the interview, I mean, the style I wasn't doing it in the internet sense. I was doing it in the fishing sense. I was trolling a little bit. I was, coming up some boundary conditions of the conversation, and then seeing what I could do with it. And I was really surprised when he started talking about being called a hypocrite and how it bothers him, because...
Maybe he shouldn't be one, then.
Yeah.
That's what social pressure is for. You ask the question of whether the social pressure has some merit to it.
And even within the confines of our conversation, there was hypocrisy.
Yeah, and I think the one thing, the biggest piece of hypocrisy, or just the biggest reason I dislike him and don't want to listen to him, is that he's two-faced. And if there's one thing that I dislike in people, mm-hmm. it's someone that expects me to have more than one relationship with them.
Right.
That on one hand, they want to be my pal and prove to me how friendly they are, while intentionally trying to trick you into admitting that you support pedophilia. You can't do that. You can't treat somebody like that, or broadcast that somebody is less than human, or cruel or mean, and then turn around and expect me to be your pal. Either you apologize for it. I mean, I can have a civil relationship, a professional relationship, mm-hmm. with someone that I don't like. We can find a way to tolerate each other. We do this at work. We do this among, family.
Right.
And we just agree to not talk about things, or we can just go, you know what? I don't like you. You don't like me. We can admit that, but we can get along in a very limited fashion, but just not going to certain places. With Ray, it's like he thinks he can do both. He thinks he can be my friend and the guy who's trying to destroy me publicly by crushing my public perception of people wanting to think that this group that I'm in, atheists, are someone that can, support pedophilia. I mean, that thing is just so utterly shocking to me. And his use of dishonest editing, which is another thing that we don't really get into this discussion, but I mean, it's something that he is really probably most famous for, is moving answers and questions around in interviews after the fact to make people that he interviews look bad. And to think you can be somebody's friend after you treat them that way is just bonkers.
Interestingly enough, we had a little discussion about editing before the interview. we did like a 2-hour tour of Living Waters Ministries. It felt like we were there a long time, and he does this little sleight of hand stuff, and he gives you little gifts. I may talk about this some other time, but then he introduces me to his sound guy or his sound editing guy, and they start talking about sound editing, and they're sort of pre-apologizing for it. And
if you're really sorry, just don't do it.
And but you know they're couching it in professional terms, and it's like, okay, I could have this conversation with this, and I could turn this into the debate, but that felt a little bit too much like inside baseball to me. So I said, you know what? I work in radio. I know what editing is.
Yeah.
And you know, while I have a problem, I think he even said I have a problem with some of the edits that you do, I don't have a problem with editing qua editing.
No, I'm fine with that. Obviously, you have to cut things for time. I mean, you look at 60 Minutes, and then you have an interview with like the president of the United States.
Right.
They're not really talking to him for just 5 minutes. They're really talking to him more like 20 or 30.
Right.
But they have, you know, time limits because that's 60 minutes, and you only have so much time, and you can't give it only over to one topic. And I understand. So you go for the meat. You say, okay, what is the point that this person's trying to make? And I would take the strongest or punchiest part of it, the thing that I think sums up this interview and this person the best in an honest way, and you use it. What you don't do is move answers around to make somebody look bad and to make yourself look good. I have 2 podcasts, and I edit people all the time. And one of the things I'll sometimes do is have to cut for time.
Right.
So my goal is to make people smarter and more interesting. So, I mean, because I obviously I'm self-selecting because I'm picking people that I think already are smart and interesting.
Well, there's going to be some editing in this episode. In fact, what we're saying right now probably isn't going to make it to air because we go on the air in 59 minutes and I still have to tack this on to the end. Editing is a thing. It exists. It is real. But it's another thing, like you say, when you pick and choose little phrases to make it sound like you're saying something you're not or to make you look stupid.
You make yourself look good by intentionally nerfing the other person. And I think
that's the problem.
Intentionally making people look bad and being dishonest about their arguments, taking out things that are their strongest pieces or moving things around to make someone look intentionally and dishonestly bad. It's one thing if, for instance, you have like the Sarah Palin interview that she did where she just looked bad, where she couldn't name a newspaper.
Right.
I'm sorry, you dropped the ball, a microphone was in front of you, and you gave a bad answer. It's another thing if, say, Katie Couric had taken her clearing her throat from the beginning of the interview and put it after that question to make her look bad. That's what Ray Comfort does.
Yeah.
It's one thing when somebody just botches an interview. It's another thing where someone intentionally makes them look terrible.
And it's become such a problem in the atheist community. When we started doing interviews with the show on Ask an Atheist, I started a policy where I said, if you want a copy of the raw interview unedited, I will provide you with one. You may have it. And that way, if we edit in a way that you don't like, or we make it sound like you're saying something that you're not, you have the evidence. You can make your own cut. You can even edit irresponsibly yourself.
You can make a point about how you were used badly.
Yeah.
This is the other thing with Ray, is that he's just not a person you have a conversation with. And he's somebody that he wants a microphone put in front of him. He'll put this amiable face on, so he looks as friendly as possible, pat you on the back, give you a bunch of gifts. But he's not interested in talking to you like a person. He's there to have an opportunity to parrot out pre-recorded stuff. He's like a Teddy Ruxpin for Jesus. This is the thing, is he will make these things about, oh, well, these are the mean people, the people I've had to ban from my website. Not all banned for bad language, by the way.
No.
I mean, I'm an atheist. I'm on Facebook. I encounter these people all the time that like to mess around with Ray, and I get screenshots of the just minor offenses that they get thrown off for. So
again, that was a conversation I didn't take because, frankly, when he said, well, I've banned people for bad language, I was remembering the bibliophile incident.
Yeah, like he doesn't know what that is.
Yeah.
That cultural blindness comes back to bite you in the butt. And the same thing, I have a lot of atheist friends. How many of those friends, again, that two-faced thing, how many of, you know, oh, I have plenty of atheist friends. Well, there's the obvious connotation of that where you just kind of go, oh, you don't want to use that phrase. Mm-hmm. But also the question of, are they really your friends? Or there's someone that you're just friendly to, you give a bunch of gifts and books and signed stuff to, and then you go around talking about how they're walking human garbage.
Yeah.
It's so insincere that I don't like somebody that can't have an honest relationship with me, especially when you're broadcasting the ill treatment of them to a much bigger audience than the private friendliness. People see you treating me badly. People see you misediting me. And when he goes into these things like, you know, oh, we only have cancer because of the fallen human creation and stuff. You know, there's plenty of Christians out there that get cancer, good people who get cancer. You know, it's like he just starts spewing spewing out these assertions and this mess of doublethink. And I really think that the worst thing that he really does is there's this ugly religious philosophy that's behind everything he has, that we're all inherently ugly and broken.
Yeah.
And that this is the one thing you can do to fix it. And you bring this up, the idea of, wait a minute, you're just saying that I'm a criminal right out of the gate?
Yeah.
And this idea that this tyrant he has, oh, that's actually merciful. That's actually merciful that I give you this. It's, and you'd feel so grateful that someone would pay the toll for your fine to get you out of jail, that you'll be a good person. Well, yeah, well, what about Maurice Clemens? Maurice Clemens was a guy who made all the right noises and joined the right club, and they were so happy that for religious reasons, they let him out of prison and he murders four cops. I mean, this is not how reality operates.
Right.
And of course, I bet you that if you asked Ray Comfort about that, he'd have his pre-given answer of, oh, well, he wasn't a real Christian.
Well, yeah, we are talking about somebody who has a video called True and False Conversion. He would say it was a false conversion, so he wasn't a real Christian, therefore it doesn't count.
He's a real Christian until he does something that you don't like, and then suddenly he gets retconned into being not a real Christian that whole time.
However, Christianity is faith, not works. Even though you're judged by, your faith is judged by, whatever.
It's a garbage philosophy.
It's garbage, yeah.
If you want to have a philosophy that gives you the freedom to do whatever you want, including some god-awful, horrible things to other people, but always have that escape clause as long as I say I'm sorry, not to the person you're wrong, but to the person that doesn't necessarily exist, and you can do it inside your head so no one can hear you actually show contrition for it. Christianity, especially Ray Comfort's brand, is a way to go. There is just an ugliness to it, and the idea that it's not a morality. This is like talking to farm animals. This is just a set of rules. He says, it's like the pedophilia thing again.
Right.
It's like the best argument he can come up with for why pedophilia is wrong is that it's against the rules. And if that's the only and best reason, he seemed to think that if this idea of, as long as I film this person, this child, in secrecy, that aside from it being against the rules, I take God out of the equation, I shouldn't be able to find anything wrong with that.
Now,
and if that's the thing that bothers me, is he really saying that if you take the God out of the equation, he can't see anything wrong with it?
I have a question about that. Does he really think that? This is like I was walking away and I said, I should have asked him this. Does he really think that? Or was he doing what I thought he was doing?
Trolling?
Which was, adopting that in order to get us to say that pedophilia is okay.
That's the thing. The fact that, one, it goes to him being an insincere jerk, the idea of trying to be your friend and then try to trick you into saying that. But
right.
Also, I take the philosophy that it doesn't really matter whether he believes it or not. The question of whether he's sincere in his beliefs is both the most relevant and least relevant question at the same time. Because it doesn't really matter, because the people who buy his tapes, the people who hand out his literature for him, by the hundreds, those people all believe.
Right.
And these are the arguments they use to justify their own belief. And again, the question of faith not works, I think it's terrible, because we've both encountered people who use the fact that they're very, very religious to cover the fact that they treat people terribly.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, it's a question, and you mentioned this in the interview, of harm. That's how you judge whether you're a good person. How do you treat other people? Especially, how do you treat other people when there's nothing for you to gain by treating them well?
Right.
It's like, how do you treat a waiter? I think that if I'm going to dinner with somebody, how they treat a help staff, how they treat a waiter, how they treat someone who cleans their tables, is very telling about what kind of person they are. And Ray Comfort, he's really talking about, oh, well, this God can give me all these things. I'm only doing this stuff because I'm so grateful for this gift he's given me for free, so I'm going to be a good person. Well, that's not the best. That's one of the worst reasons to be a good people.
Yeah, that doesn't smell like morality to me, honestly.
Morality is not about doing something because you're afraid of punishment or out of gratefulness for a reward. Morality is about not wanting to do something because you don't want the effects of it.
Right.
That I don't kill somebody because I know what it feels like to lose a loved one. Not necessarily violently, but I imagine that the pain of losing somebody violently is like having a death times 100, because it feels like this didn't have to happen. This wasn't heart disease or something. This was something that was violently taken from you. And imagine how traumatic that would be. The ability to just use empathy, basic human empathy, just the idea of, as they say in To Kill a Mockingbird, putting on someone else's shoes and walking around a little bit.
Yeah, it's a morality that doesn't have empathy as a real component. They talk a good empathy game, but there's not a real empathy yet.
It's a farm animal mentality that I'm doing this because it's against the rules. Why does a cow not leave the pasture? Because there's an electric fence there and it gets punished if it tries to leave.
Farm animal or animal farm?
It's a little bit of both, really. it's just a set of rules on the wall.
Yeah.
And the idea, this is good, that is bad. Why is it? Because that person said so. Authority doesn't make something right or wrong. And this is why I think that he focuses on Darwin so much, is that he seems to think that we exist in the exact same template that he does.
Right.
That we have savior, we have prophet, we have holy script. And he thinks if he can damage one of those, he damages our non-belief.
That was a big point, is I actually tried to bring that up with him, is like, okay, you printed Origin of the Species, you didn't include certain chapters, and they were chapters that strengthened your argument. Now, did you do that because you saw Origin of the Species as like the Bible of atheists, or because, you know, were you trying to make that sort of point, or was it purely for economical reasons? And it turns out to be for economic reasons. The important thing to him was the foreword, was getting those copies of Origin of the Species out with his stuff in the middle. The Origin of the Species part didn't really matter as much, which leads me to like the final two questions I have for you. The first one is, do you think Ray Comfort is harmful?
Yes, I do. I think that he's on the same wavelength as William Lane Craig, where he says terrible things, and what he does is not necessarily that he has the same ability as they, like, he doesn't have the same influence as the Pope, okay. For instance.
Right.
The Pope has the ability to go into countries where no other people can go and give aid, and then also put in this really harmful thing about, say, condoms and the prevention of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
There's millions of deaths coming out of that. Ray Comfort, though, gives really dumb people, because William Lane Craig, I guess, is the upscale version with a nice label of apologetics, where Ray Comfort is really the Kmart brand.
Okay.
But he basically helps cement people in bad thinking, and his arguments are really dumb. But again, arguments don't have to be smart, they only have to be as good as the person you're throwing it. Not that the person has to be dumb, but the person can also deliberately want something to be true. And we see this on the internet all the time, where somebody forwards something that's really from the Daily Current or the Onion because they like what it says or they want to get angry at it.
Right. But he's not like, but he doesn't have that influence. He's not, he's not Billy Graham. He's not Jerry Falwell. He's not Pat Robertson. He doesn't have, you know, he has millions of dollars, but he doesn't have hundreds of millions of dollars. He doesn't have his television network. His audience is pretty small. He doesn't seem, I'm not saying he's harm free,
yeah,
but he doesn't seem that dangerous to me.
No, he's not. I wouldn't say that he's harm free. Exactly what you said. Maurice Clemens is not Joseph Stalin,
right?
In terms of the number of deaths you can put on this person, but I wouldn't say he's harmless.
Okay,
but the amount of harm he does is minimal. And I think that the way I would describe Ray Comfort, I don't know if you've seen the movie Undercover Blues. This is a '90s movie with Kathleen Turner.
Does it have Jim Belushi in it?
No, it doesn't.
Oh, sounds like exactly the kind of movie.
It's a Dennis Quaid movie.
Oh, okay.
So in this movie, they play
Jim Belushi wasn't available.
Dennis Quaid and Kathleen Turner play a pair of retired spies who just had a baby and they're on vacation in New Orleans. And there's this character played by Stanley Tucci who pops in and out of the story. He's a thief and a mugger, and he goes by the name of Muerte. And Muerte takes himself very seriously, and he's constantly attacking the Blues and trying to rob them or kill them. And because he's way out of his league, because these are like CIA people, they beat the crap out of him and mock him, and they call him Morty to his face, and they knock him around. He's a clown. It's or Ultros, the evil, useless octopus from the Final Fantasy games. Same sort of thing, which is he's a clown. The Blues don't fight him because they're worried he's going to take over the world or hurt people. They fight him because it's kind of fun to sharpen their teeth and laugh at him.
Yeah.
Ray Comfort is our Muerte.
Okay.
He's a clown that you can practice your argument skills on, that you can mess around with. You're not saving the world by battling him. It's fun.
Yeah.
You're doing it because you're basically just trolling him and beating him up in arguments for the lulz, but you're not actually battling a real enemy. This is not a worthy foe.
I kind of see him as John Edwards, I guess, would be the way I would describe it.
You're talking about the presidential candidate or the psychic?
Maybe both, but specifically the presidential candidate. He's a quintessential, he's everything that we talk about when we think of a politician. There's the Ray Comfort that I had the conversation with before the interview. He was jovial, he was friendly, he was very interactive, he was very kind. We joke together. And then there's the Ray Comfort that sort of comes out when the microphones turn on. And he's all about message, all about point. He practically doesn't listen to what he's saying. His body language and if you listen to the interview, I have to edit him differently for time when he's just talking to us versus when he's in a spiel. When I'm sitting with him, his body habitus, the way he sits there, changes from when he's interacting with us to when he falls into the spiel. And what I'm seeing is an incredibly bifurcated individual. I see the nice Ray, and I see the Ray on a mission that doesn't care if they hurt people. And that Ray, the bad Ray, manipulates the kind Ray in order to get to the positions that he wants. And it ends up creating this thing that I don't know if it's hypocrisy, but it looks and smells like hypocrisy. And I do feel a little bit bad for the guy, but then I remember he's not harm-free, and that kind of goes away. I was looking for a human moment, and I really don't feel like I got it.
Well, I don't think there's a lot of human underneath the curtain. It's sort of like if you in The Wizard of Oz, mm-hmm. there's the big floating head, and then there's that little machine with a curtain. You know, pay attention, no attention to the man behind the curtain. It's like pulling that open, and there's just a tape recorder back there.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like that's what Ray Comfort is.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking the end of...
All this was is a speaker.
Yeah.
It was never anything there, but it's like you talk to him. You're inconsequential when you have a conversation with him, because he already knows what he's going to say. Again, it's like talking to Teddy Ruxpin.
I'd like to thank Ray Comfort and Living Waters Ministries, Kent Martin, Rebecca Friedman, and Mike Gillis. My name is Sam Mulvey. Our music for this episode is Cloud Seeds by Pet Ghost Project. This is the first episode of Professional Refutationalist Quarterly. For more information, go to askanatheist.tv. Watch for our next episode in March 2014. Ask an Atheist returns next week. See you then.